From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in today for Evan Dawson, and our connection this hour goes all the way back to the 7th century, when a new religion called Islam began its rise alongside a then-youthful Christianity and a Jewish religion that was already thousands of years old. But 1,400 years later, Judaism and Islam are still trying to figure out how to coexist in many parts of the world, and not just the obvious ones either. Tariq Fatah's roots are in India and Pakistan, but he's made a name for himself in Canada as an outspoken voice against Muslim anti-Semitism. He's a talk show host, a columnist, and author of books including The Jew Is Not My Enemy, and he's coming to Rochester on Sunday as a guest of Rock for Israel. He joins us now by phone from across the border. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Welcome to Connections. I want to begin by talking a little bit about your background, because there's nothing in your background initially that would suggest that you would be interested in a topic like Muslim anti-Semitism. You are originally of Indian descent. Your family embraced Islam. Talk to me a little bit about how you came to this topic, if you would.
Well, to begin with, anti-Semitism is quite an unfamiliar area in the Indian subcontinent. The Jews, I think India was the only place where there was literally none. The Jews are held in very high esteem. And even after the creation of the first Islamic state, under a very racist principle of Muslims and Hindus, Muslims considering themselves not willing to live under a Hindu majority, that state was created. I remember in my childhood, the Jews still being seen as people of wisdom. I remember, and I mentioned that in my book, a movie that came out that was a big hit was a stage play called The Daughter of the Jew, and in which this Jewish woman is the main star, and in a very positive way. And until 1967, the 1967 war between Egypt and Israel and Syria and Jordan, there was very little anti-Semitism, but that changed dramatically. And it has now become staple diet throughout the Islamic world. There are, you know, verses in the Quran and in Sharia and in Hadith which are particularly offensive, can be seen as offensive to Jews. In fact, the opening paragraph of the Quran is translated by the Saudis as saying that do not, it puts the Christians and Jews in very bad light. So as soon as the Saudis started dominating the Islamic narrative after the 1971 war, 73 war, where the oil crisis broke loose and they got hundreds of billions of dollars, didn't know what to do with it, there's never been going back from southern Philippines to, I would say, San Bernardino. The Jew is the enemy for any Muslim, especially Muslims of Pakistan, because they have no other ethnic identity. And in that other empty ethnicity, their identity suddenly becomes anti-Hindu, and in North America, a very pronounced anti-Jewish.
We are talking with Tariq Fatah. Am I pronouncing that correctly, by the way?
Yes.
Who is the author of The Jew Is Not My Enemy, Unveiling the Myths That Fuel Muslim Anti-Semitism. I expect that we will get some phone calls this hour. I want to open up the lines early and make sure that you can start getting calls in. You can join us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, locally in Rochester at 263-9994. And you can also find me on Twitter at Scott Feibusch, and feel free to reach out to us that way as well. Tariq Fatah will be here in Rochester Sunday night at the Irondequoit Country Club. He will be in conversation with Dr. A.J. Cascetta from RIT, who is a fellow of the Middle East Forum, a senior lecturer at RIT, and focuses on radical Islamists and Islamic terrorism. I want to mention also that next month we will be talking on the show, Evan will be talking on the show, to Norman Ornstein, who will be a guest of the local Jewish Federation, providing another perspective on this discussion. There are certainly a lot of angles to be had here. We can't always bring all the voices in a particular debate into the room at the very same time, but we want to give the community a chance to hear from them overall. And we do want to hear from you at 844-295-TALK. You mentioned in your book that the first Jewish friend that you had wasn't until 1993. How old were you at that point, and what were the circumstances there?
Well, I was interviewed for a job with the Minister of Citizenship, and it just happened that I found out that my chief of staff, the minister's chief of staff, was an Australian Jewish immigrant, the wonderful Julius Deutsch, who has since passed away. And it was crossing a threshold, you know, not only that, because he was also gay. And I had never met or even engaged with someone who was openly gay or was Jewish. And I didn't know how to react to that situation. I've always been a very strong supporter of the Palestinian state. And but I've also always maintained that without recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, the next step cannot be taken. And we didn't discuss much politics. It was a political appointment. It was a left of center government in Ontario over here. Premier Bob Rae was a wonderful head of government.
I wrote the foreword to your book also.
Yes. And so it was an education. You know, I'd only recently come to Canada. I'd come here in 87. So for me, it was a very early start into understanding anti-Semitism, homophobia from a North American perspective. It was a good chance. I was very fortunate, I would say.
I want to ask you to put North America sort of in perspective here. Obviously, you know, particularly in the context of the presidential campaign that is now underway on this side of the border, and to a lesser extent the campaign season that you've just gotten through in Canada. These topics in the U.S. all of a sudden are taking much greater prominence than they did even a few years ago, and you know, not so much in the sense of anti-Semitism, but in the sense of anti-Islam. You suggest in your book, there's an entire chapter that's devoted to some of the conspiracy theories that you experienced, particularly in Pakistan, some of the conspiracy theories that are put out there about Jews by people who don't tend to encounter Jews in day-to-day existence. Is there a parallel that can be drawn there in terms of some of the image that's being put out there about Islam in parts of America where people may not necessarily encounter Islam in their day-to-day lives?
I think that would be a very dangerous parallel to make, because Americans have encountered Islam on a day-to-day basis after 9/11. There is no going back. Just San Bernardino massacre, Major Nidal Hassan killing American soldiers. And no matter what the Obama administration or before him, President Bush, would try to say to mollify calm down American anger, people talk about fear. I think there is palpable anger in the ordinary American who seems to be manipulated by the establishment. And you can see that in the strong support for Mr. Sanders and Mr. Trump on both the left and the right. And Mr. Trump seems to have tapped into that. I'm not saying that in a very negative way. I'm just saying that he expresses that frustration that President Obama can't even get to utter the word Islamic extremism. Not only that, the American population quite understands the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in the American White House. The first speech writers of President Obama, the American ambassador to the Islamic countries, the Assistant Secretary of State who was recently fired. There are tons of examples of Islamist influence within the United States. American Islamic organizations are as hostile to Jews, but they do it under the garb of being critical of Israel, and people can see through that. It is the common decency of the American people that no one has reacted in a way in which I've seen in Denmark or Holland or even in Germany and France. Yet America is portrayed again and again by the same people who live in the United States as the enemy. They might say something else when the microphones are on and the cameras are rolling, but they can pretty well fool a whole lot of bleeding heart white liberals, but they can't fool us who are Muslims and who have been in the political frame for the last 45 years. We can see through this hogwash, as we call it in Canada. The hostility towards Western civilization is quite marked in what I call Muslim Brotherhood groups that operate quite freely and are invited to the White House by President Obama. That's very disturbing. And ordinary Americans who feel disturbed by this are castigated aside as being, oh, well, those must be the racists, you know, the white trash that doesn't know how to think. The common notion that the ordinary American is stupid is so widespread in Islamist discourse, it stuns me, you know. But the leadership of the mosque, the Islamic leadership in the United States, is guilty of never once having confronted anti-Semitism or recognizing Israel's right to be a Jewish state as sanctioned by the United Nations, the Security Council, and recognizing that the rejection of the Palestinian state did not come from the Israelis, it came from the Arab countries. But it's a very long discussion. And the damage has been done to quite a degree by Saudi money and its influence in the United States.
We are talking with Tariq Fatah on Connections. You are welcome to join us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or locally here in Rochester, 263-9994. It seems to me that you have built yourself an interesting position here as someone who is of Islamic heritage. Do you consider yourself a practicing Muslim?
Well, yes, I am. Yeah. You see, I'll tell you something very interesting. Most of the early Muslims, the companions of Prophet Muhammad, became Muslims before even the Quran was revealed. So then it begs the discussion, who is a Muslim and what does it take to be a Muslim? We have now become prisoners of a political entity that is called a Muslim, which I would refer to as Islamists who utilize Islam as a political tool, almost in a way the papacy or the popes were doing it in the 12th and 13th century. And it is being funded primarily by the Gulf Arab states and Saudi Arabia in the type of money they give to the mosque establishment, including in the United States, and how they pay for the clerics and the initial money that takes to build a mosque. And the network is wide across the United States, right into Canada, right up to the North Pole, by the way. Just day before yesterday, I read the news that they were building a mosque over there. And the notion is not prayer or spirituality. The notion is to use the mosque as claiming a territory, or wearing the hijab or the face mask as asserting themselves as saying, we are here to stay, and we will use the United States Constitution or the Canadian Constitution to establish ourselves, and you can't do a damn thing about it. I mean, America can't even unlock an iPhone, for goodness sake. And the ISIS guys are able to kill dozens of people. What does it say to the Islamists, to ISIS, to Taliban, to Al-Qaeda, that every Tom, Dick, and Harry on the streets of America is saying, my privacy, and on the other side, they've got tens of thousands of people being beheaded. Imagine if this was the attitude during the Second World War. Hitler would have won. People in America would have been talking about the rights of the Nazis.
One could argue, on the other hand, if you look at the experience, say, of the Japanese during World War II, that perhaps there were violations in the opposite direction.
Of course there were, but the point is, during war, we have the luxury of peacetime security to pass judgment at a time when, in a five-year period, 30 million, only Russia lost 30 million people. The Indians lost a million people. The Chinese had a million casualties. Can you imagine in a five-year period, the Americans had very few losses? I mean, it was primarily the Germans, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Japanese that had casualties. The Americans, I think, lost a few hundred thousand people. It's quite a lot, but still compared to 30 million Russians dying in that five-year war is horrific. But imagine at that time, Mr. Roosevelt came with Mr. Stalin, sat down with Chiang Kai-shek, sat down with the French leadership, the German resistance, the Italian resistance. There was even people from New York and the Italian mafia that went over to fight. We made allies to put down fascism and gave up blood and sweat. And today we can't give up an iPhone? What does it say about America that a corporation can tell the rest of the country you can go to hell? My profits matter more than the security of this country, and the people are talking of privacy. I mean, Secretary of State Clinton's materials are being pushed out in the public. WikiLeaks has thrown everything about America on the public. Snowden is a hero for destroying America's security. Don't you think that the Islamists or the Jew and Christian haters, those who want to destroy human civilization, don't you think they're having a laugh at our cost while we debate about some teenager's privacy?
I want to bring our audience in here. Kathy from Chila, you are on with Tarak Fatah. You have some questions about some of his views?
Yeah, I actually have a number of issues about him. I think that, you know, he's coming at this from an Indian continent point of view, which, you know, they got their land back after colonialism. You know, the Europeans moved out. The Palestinians didn't. And I really think if a Palestinian state had been created initially, that maybe they, Arabs in the Middle East, would not be hating the West. I don't think that terrorism arose because the sky is blue. I think that there were certain things that they took issue with. And then the whole privacy thing, that is a whole nother issue. I think that Apple is truly right in saying that there are dissidents worldwide that whose protection, you know, right now they can't be found by their own government because of privacy on the iPhones or whatever. And if Apple gives into that, I think that you have governments in China and other places that will be able to crack down on their own dissidents. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. I want to try to sort of steer things away from the whole privacy discussion, because I think that's a separate
piece
from what we have.
Let me get to the Palestinian issue.
But yeah, if you get onto that issue, I want to ask you specifically too, because there's an interesting historical, at least coincidence, if not parallel, that at precisely the same time, 1,000 miles away, you had the separation of India and Pakistan, which ended up giving you what was essentially a two-nation, eventually a three-nation solution. And then you had the situation with Israel, which, as we know, has, led to, at this point, close to 70 years of failing to find a permanent solution there. What do you see, from your perspective as of Indian heritage, what do you see as having been the essential difference there?
Let me begin by answering our guest's question first.
Please.
It was not the Israelis who rejected the Palestinian state. This needs to be very clear. Israel and the Arab state of Palestine are the only nations created under the sanction of the United Nations and the Security Council. Israel accepted both states, and the 14 Arab nations that attacked Israel in 1948 are the ones who rejected it. Now, between 1948 and 1967, the territories that today I would support to be a Palestinian state, which is the West Bank and Gaza, were in Arab hands. They were not Israeli occupied. Gaza was under the occupation of Egypt, and the West Bank was under the occupation of Jordan. None of the, during in this entire period, they did not establish a capital in East Jerusalem, or all of Jerusalem was in the control of the Jordanians. The concept by saying that Palestine doesn't exist because Israel is not permitting it is false. Number one, Palestine does need to exist. A Palestinian state should be created. But to blame Israel is a very thinly veiled anti-Semitic step, and it hides the essential hatred of the Jew that can be hidden by most of the left and the Islamist, which is a very sort of an unholy alliance. Now, going to India that you pointed out is a completely different situation. India was literally amputated. Both its arms were cut off in one of the most horrific crimes committed on humanity. Just a couple of years after the Holocaust, 1 million people died in a 100-square-mile area. At no stage in India's 5,000-year history has this happened. Imagine a Mecca where there would be no Muslims. That's what happened to the River Indus. India comes from the River Indus. The name is associated with that. Today, what is the birthplace of Hinduism was completely cleansed of every Hindu who were sent packing to India. So a number of crimes were committed, and we cannot make parallels. We need to see these separately. But coming back to the Middle East, I find it very disturbing that some of the most right-wing elements in the Islamist movement have suddenly found to come under the same tent as what I would consider left-wing liberals. It's astonishing that the very women who are feminists, who demand women's equal rights, are quite comfortable if in a mosque a woman is sent to the back of the bus, which happened when President Obama recently went to a Baltimore mosque. Not a single woman was allowed to pray in the front row. And the president of the United States was quite comfortable with that. How is it possible that we hold a different standard unless and until what I refer to as left-wing Orientalism, which suggests that, well, these Muslims really aren't human beings. Once they grow up to be human beings, then we'll allow them to treat men and women as equal. Absolute nonsense. My mother, my daughters, and my wife cannot be treated as second-class citizens in the house of God. And this is happening with the sanction of progressive left-wing people that I looked up to, like Mr. Chomsky or a number of leading intellectuals in the United States, or the feminist movement or the labor movement. And today those people are on the side of the ultra-right without knowing anything about what's happening.
It seems to me that there are some odd bedfellows all around in this, and I want to continue this after we take a quick break. We are talking with Tariq Fatah, who is the author of The Jew Is Not My Enemy. He's on the phone with us from Canada, where he is the founder of the Muslim Canadian Congress and also a talk show host and columnist and very active on Twitter as well. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Oh, Tariq Fatah, at Tariq Fatah, T-A-R-E-K-F-A-T-A-H.
And he will be here in Rochester in an event presented by Rock for Israel. That takes place Sunday, February 28th at Irondequoit Country Club. Free and open to the public. There's information on that at rockforisrael.org. We'll continue with Tariq Fatah and with you as well, 844-295-TALK, as we continue our conversation on Connections.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, first hour, ending the R word. You've probably heard the annual campaign focusing on that word. We'll talk about how things are going there and new movements designed to push it forward. Then second hour, TaylorMade, a new documentary about the garment industry, and Hickey Freeman and Rochester's role at the center of it. Talk with you Monday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
In 1927, the Supreme Court ruled that the Commonwealth of Virginia could sterilize Carrie Buck. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes notoriously wrote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough."
He didn't just uphold the Virginia law. He wrote really a clarion call saying, "We need to do a lot more of this. Our nation is at risk. Go to it."
Buck v. Bell and American Eugenics later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be 4 o'clock this afternoon on your NPR News station.
And welcome back to Connections. I am Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson today, and on the phone with us, Tariq Fatah, who is coming to Rochester on Sunday as a guest of Rock for Israel. Just to mention, you know, we make the seat available to all sorts of viewpoints here on Connections. Next month, Norman Ornstein will be on with Evan. He'll be a guest of the local Jewish Federation and coming at things, I suspect, from sort of a different perspective. I want to get back to what we started discussing right before the break about bedfellows and alliances, because it seems to me you have yourself in something of an interesting position. What is it like to be in a position where perhaps you have more allies at this point in parts of the Jewish community than in a lot of parts of the Muslim community? What is that like on a personal level for you, and how does that affect the way that you shape your arguments?
Well, at times it leads to ammunition for many in the Muslim community to accuse me of being an Israeli agent or an Indian agent or being Islamophobic. But I've been singularly focused on fighting Islamism since about 45 years. A lot has changed. I've seen the Cold War. And I've seen the betrayal of so many people when they found out what the Soviet Union was actually, what it did and how millions died. I still vote left-wing. I've run for the NDP, which is left of the Democratic Party here in Canada. I still consider myself to be somewhere close to what Mr. Sanders is. In fact, my Facebook page has him with a picture. But I can't help what other people think. I think we are in a war with Islamofascism, and people who are not Muslim need to understand a very fundamental threat that does not exist in any other form of authoritarian rule. Take, for example, the Nazis or the communists. They wanted to dominate the world and rule it. The Islamofascists, on the other hand, wish to dominate the world to destroy it. It's a death cult in which the Islamists and, in fact, most religious Muslims believe that life on earth is like a transit lounge at, say, London's Heathrow Airport. So if I'm flying from here, or New York to, say, Tokyo, and all I'm concerned in London Heathrow is looking at my connecting flight. And for most Islamists and religious Muslims, the connecting flight is to paradise. People are not concerned who maintains the transit lounge. Those lounges, or whether it's the toilet or the cafeteria, they don't give a damn. They just want to have a coffee, go for a pee, catch a flight, and go on. It's the closest example I can give to you. But everyone I know from my childhood, those who propagate Sharia law, all believe in end of times. not in a way that Christian belief is or Judaic belief is. The Hindu belief is in, coming back on a return flight in another form. We are being told and educated that Muslims have to dominate, convert the rest of the world, force them to Islam, have these two wars, one against what we call Rome, or which is Europe, and the other called Ghazwa-e-Hind, which is the war on India. And once these two wars take place, the Messiah will come and lead all of us to paradise or to hell. And this is not some fictitious tale that we joke about. It is endorsed in some of the most educated Muslims I've met, academics, who sincerely believe in this. I mean, for non-Muslims sometimes, they think it's a joke. It's not a joke. These are like people, a death cult like Jim Jones, going political in a way and leading people to death. That is why 10-year-olds are putting on vests and blowing themselves up, or children are beheading adults in ISIS.
Is there a danger, though? You know, you made the claim there that most religious Muslims hold these beliefs, and I think if you were to talk, certainly from talking with the leaders of our local Islamic community in Rochester, I think they would very strongly dispute that assertion. You write in one of the opening chapters of your book about this attack on Jews in India, this horrible attack on the Chabad house in Bombay.
Yeah.
And you write there, you know, very pointedly that the Islamic community in India would not allow these attackers to be buried in their cemeteries, and eventually the government had to find a way to dispose of the bodies because they were not accepted as being Muslim by the rest of the Muslim community there.
That is true.
That is
where Muslims are in a minority. Where, when the mics are on and the cameras are rolling, you have to say one thing. Compare that to what is happening in Pakistan when this happened, or the recent attacks on India by the Pakistani jihadis. They are celebrated. Suicide bombers in the West Bank, their mothers are celebrating them. There is no mourning for a suicide bomber. I mean, top clerics have defended suicide bombing. Now, I can understand when North America, when a Muslim group in Rochester will obviously say, well, what Mr. Fatah is saying is wrong. But let them come on and talk about this and say, doesn't the Sharia say about the final battle that ISIS today says is taking place, in the very town in Syria where this is supposed to take place? And what is the theory about the Ghazwa-e-Hind, the attack on India? It's all in the Sharia. My point is that we need to come together and become what I call the First Amendment Muslims, which means that religion will have nothing to do with our politics. Unfortunately, there's such a large appetite for religion and politics, as demonstrated by Mr. Cruz and so many of his followers, that the Muslim Islamists who believe in theocracy sneak into that area under their cover and say, well, if they can have it, we can have it too.
Is there not also, though, you know, there's certainly in some portions of the extreme right wing right now, at least on this side of the border, you have people like Pamela Geller who are coming at this from a nominally Jewish perspective. And I got to tell you, to put my cards on the table, I'm part of the Reform Jewish community here in Rochester. I look at the things that she says about Islam and the sort of broad brush that she uses to try to tar all of Islam as the enemy, or even Donald Trump, you know, the statements we shouldn't allow them in the country at all, and the number of people who agree with him. I look at that as somebody who's married into a family that lost members in the Holocaust. I look at that, and that scares me, because I'm seeing just as much parallel on that side. Would you argue that where do you come down on that piece of the movement?
Well, Pamela Geller is not helpful in this movement. This is not her fight. The issue for non-Muslims is not what Muslims believe. Islam is not the problem. It's Islamism that's the problem. Both Bridget Gabriel, Robert Spencer, you know, a whole lot of people are never answering the question, what is to be done? The difference is that I, as a Muslim, and a whole lot of others, including groups that went and demonstrated outside President Obama's prayer visit, who were Muslims, the Wall Street Journal writer Asra Nomani, there are a whole lot of other folks that I know. Their position is to take 12th century medieval Sharia laws out of our politics. We need to be Muslim in our private lives and use Islam as a moral compass. Now, what Pamela Geller is saying is, I've followed her and Robert Spencer and Bridget Gabriel. They're basically saying, look, I told you these guys are crap. That's not going to, we're not going to disappear. There are a billion Muslims on earth. We're not going to go somewhere. You can't put us on a spaceship and say, oh, jettison them. No, we're part and parcel of the 6 billion people who live on earth. The problem is we have rotten leadership. Can you imagine that our future is in the hands of people who live in Saudi Arabia as kings or ayatollahs, where you're having an election today where women can't even vote unless the head is covered, or in Pakistan where the Taliban was created, where ISIS is founding, where there's a genocide going on in Balochistan? The Muslim leadership today is pathetic. In fact, it doesn't even exist. The biggest crooks in the world live in Saudi Arabia and Iran. And Saudi Arabia is a big ally of the United States. At some stage, some American would have to say, the people who blew up 9/11 or the buildings, how could they be our allies? So I'm not on the same boat as many of the critics of Islam. I don't have a problem with Islam. I just know one thing, that Islam for me means five things, which have absolutely nothing to do with politics. I'm supposed to give an annual wealth tax of 2.5% on my assets. I got to go once in my lifetime to do Hajj, which I've done twice. I got to fast 30 days in a year to you know, make my links with the poor and the hungry and understand how privileged I am, which I do, and pray daily to God, which sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I can't be judged as a human being based on my religiosity. I should be based on what I offer to society and what I live with other people with whom I do not agree. Everybody embraces a friend. The challenge is to embrace your adversary, and that is the real measure of a human being. Not to be driven up into these tribal cavalcades of us versus them, which are not the solution. And I keep bringing up the Second World War. We had an alliance of people who were diametrically opposite to each other, but who had one goal in mind, the destruction of fascism and Aryan supremacy, that all human beings are born equal. And from there came civil rights, the 8-hour you know, work day, the equality of men and women, all stem from the world coming together to defeat Hitler and Hirohito. Today we are tied up in silly notions where newspapers are dying, everything is a headline, and we are all proud to be American or proud to be Muslim or proud to be Canadian. We need to be proud of what we accomplish, not what we inherit.
We are talking with Tariq Fatah. I want to make some time for some of our callers to get in here because we do have some lines full here at 844-295-8255. John, thank you for staying with us from Rochester. Your question.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Turoff. Turoff, the Jews originally welcomed Muhammad into Medina, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
And with open arms, and he turned on them after a short period of time and became sort of a genocidal maniac. And
no, this brings up one of the chapters of the book.
Let me clarify that. I know where you're coming from. I've spent 5 years researching those stories. The division between Muhammad and his Jewish host came when the rabbi said that we consider you to be a monotheist and as a great man, but you're not the Messiah. And this had been decided in the Talmud, and that's where the difference of opinion came. As far as the Prophet Muhammad killing 700 people, trust me, I have gone even to the sites. I've gone to Jewish books going back to the 12th century. There is no mention of any genocide of Jews by Prophet Muhammad in any Jewish book. They are all in the books written 200 years by Muslims after Muhammad's death to justify their anti-Semitism. So they created the story that the Jews have to be killed because Muhammad killed the Jews. I'm looking for any, and mind you, you cannot blame the Jews for not having written about their own tribulations. Well,
he didn't discriminate.
In the Jewish texts.
He didn't discriminate. He went after everyone. I've read a couple different books. One book I read was by William Federer, who's a supposed historian. And he didn't discriminate. He murdered and committed genocide against any religion or any non-religion.
No. Okay, let me put it this way. His own mosque used to be a church on Sundays because Muslims don't use the mosque on Sunday mornings. That is evidence from Ethiopian Christians. When he reconquered Mecca, there was no massacre of the pagans over there. Of course, I know of a few people who were identified and killed. I don't defend that. I'm quite comfortable in saying that was not the right thing to do. But all the pagans in Mecca were allowed to continue as they are. Pity is that today no non-Muslim can even go to Mecca.
Well, according to Federer, he massacred 2 or 3 tribes in Medina before his death.
Look, the evidence that Federer gives is from Islamic texts. And what I'm suggesting to you is that the Islamic empires of the Umayyads and later the Abbasids, that's the time when Prophet Muhammad's biographies are written by people who made these claims. It's called the Sirah of Muhammad. Now, there is no evidence in the Jewish texts about these massacres. This is my point, that every tribulation that the Jews have suffered throughout the history, and there are many, have all been documented. The tribulations or the massacre of Jews in Medina are only mentioned in Muslim texts that followed 200 years after Prophet Muhammad's death. And this is why my point being that by attacking the Prophet and attacking Islam, we come to no solution. Neither the 6 million or 3 million American Muslims are going anywhere, nor are the 1 billion who live across the world. The issue is to ask Muslims to take their religion out of politics and not to celebrate all the symbols of Islamofascism that President Obama and before him President Bush did it.
All right, I want to jump in here because we're getting down to the end of the show here.
Okay,
John, thank you so much for the call. I want to get into this issue of religion and politics and religion and public life at all, and I want to bring in Rich. You've got a question specifically about somebody who's been very prominent in saying there shouldn't be religion. Period.
Yeah, I'm speaking about Sam Harrison. Sam Harris basically says that some of the tenets and many of the tenets and beliefs of religion inherently cause these type of problems that we're talking about. And he feels that we need to ferret out religion in general, but he speaks really right now a lot to the Islamic religion and their tenets and the danger of him. The people are attacking him as a bigot, whereas he seems to be talking about sort of the same thing like you are, saying we have to get rid of these ideas. He's never talking about getting rid of the people or punishing the people, but he talks about clarity, not these destructive ideas that he thinks are inherently made in themselves.
All right, Rich, we're having a little... Are you on a speakerphone there, Rich?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant to take, turn that off.
Oh, yeah, let me give, because we're just down to the last few minutes here. I want to give Tarek a chance to respond to that.
Look,
yeah, please do.
There are people who believe, who are atheists or agnostics, and they are a very insignificant minority. Religion has played a great role in taking the pain out of the people's lives. They look for salvation. Some of you might think, well, it's silly or irrational for horses to fly or snakes to talk or monkeys to move mountains. And I understand that. But you don't have a right to take away from an individual his or her religious belief. Let them have it. All we need to say is, public law cannot be based on medieval texts. Laws in our society are made so that the next generation might change them. The context of pre-nation state laws was that they were from the divine and anyone who changed them had to be killed. That needs to be told to the Muslims leadership that time is gone. You want to go back to the 12th century? Fine, build a time machine. We are in the 21st, and we're not going back. This is not about Islam or Christianity. This is about how nation states, citizens, citizenship is based not on inherited religion or race, but adoption of laws that were created by legislators, people elected, who are our forefathers and who went before us. It's something that has escaped the Islamic world because the Industrial Revolution never came to us. We bypassed it, and we still are living in agrarian, feudal sort of a lifestyle, even when we live in the United States of America.
I want to ask you, we're talking with Tarek Fattah, who's the author of The Jew Is Not My Enemy. He will be in Rochester on Sunday as a guest of Rock for Israel. We're down to about our final 5 minutes here. I want to ask you, you brought up earlier Ted Cruz, and you brought up some of the elements on the right in the U.S. that, on the one hand, you describe yourself at this point as being a critic of a lot of what's happening on the left in the U.S. On the right, a lot of the things that you're talking about as being ideal, the separation of religion from politics, does that not seem to be the opposite direction of where somebody like a Ted Cruz is going in his political landscape? And where does that leave you and somebody who believes the way that you do?
Well, it scares me that someone like Cruz could be the president of the United States. Some of us have very few choices. That's why I'm hoping that the election would be between Sanders and Mr. Trump, so that a non-conventional view would come forward where people are able to speak without speaking notes. I think the greatest damage done to American democracy is the idiot card through which most politicians speak, which is in present-day terms called the teleprompter. When I was apprentice in television, it used to be called idiot cards. And there was a reason why they were called idiot cards, because can you imagine Abe Lincoln giving a speech with a PowerPoint presentation and teleprompters? Who on earth gave a speech that has ever been remembered from Athenian times to Socrates and Plato to Karl Marx or John Adams, or whoever you may take, or John F. Kennedy, with teleprompters? It's a disgrace to what has happened. That is why Bernie Sanders and Trump, on opposite sides of the equation, are generally popular, not because people are paid to be popular, but because ordinary Americans are saying, Well, at least somebody speaks like a human being. Look at the commentators on CNN, how they speak. It's embarrassing. They all say the same thing again and again and again. And you blame folks for not listening to them, whether they're on the left or the right. So I hope that it doesn't come to a Clinton versus Cruz, because I'll just shut off everything, put a blanket on top of my head and go to sleep so I don't have to listen to the result of that election.
Does it worry you, though, as a Muslim, does it worry you to see the kind of reaction that a Donald Trump gets when he makes these proposals, you know, about building walls and about blocking all Muslims from entering the U.S.?
No, actually, he didn't say that. And this is why I had serious problems with the media. He said something that we had proposed to the Canadian government, to suspend immigration from Pakistan, Somalia, Iran, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia, till we figured out how the hell do these countries give out the security certificates. What most Americans or Canadians don't know is that the security clearance of an immigrant doesn't come from the American or the Canadian side. It gets done at the other side. And imagine someone in Iran giving a security clearance to someone. Most of these Syrians are not really the refugees who need to be here. The Kurds or the Yazidis or the Christian Arabs should have been here. In Balochistan, we've got a genocide going on. None of them can come here. And you have people walking in stilettos and $500 hijabs coming to America.
We are unfortunately out of time, Tariq Fatah. Thank you for talking with us. Interesting set of perspectives.
Take care.
All right. Thank you for talking to us. He will be at the Rundaqui Country Club on Sunday, February 28th from 7 to 9. Information is at rockforisrael.org. We'll have Norman Ornstein on next month with Evan as well. Thanks for being with us. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Thank you to John Andrus behind the board, Megan Mack, our producer. Evan will be back next week. Megan will be in as well. Have a great weekend.